This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check in on educational stories and the like with Meredith Colius-Pete, who is mainly the education reporter for the Post Tribune. And Meredith, thanks for joining us today on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the stories that you covered really is more about medical issues than education issues, but it's important just the same. It's about a problem that the community hospital is trying to deal with and Medicare. Tell us the latest that you had heard about this audit that has gotten community hospital involved for a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was a story first reported in the Times that we followed up on, but basically community hospital got cited in a federal audit recently for possibly overbilling up to $22 million in Medicare, which is obviously a pretty significant amount.
86 inpatient claims that were checked out, and that's what they found, I guess, for some type of discrepancy. And that's an awful lot of money. We're talking, what, more than $1 million that was paid that should have received, I guess. And this, what is a community hospital having to say about all this?
Right. Well, just to kind of explain the process, this was an audit from the Department of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, their Office of Inspector General, and their role as auditors is to go in and make sure that, you know, they're billing properly for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So what they found was about half the claims out of a sample section of 170 that they checked, that there were problems with the billing, and that added up to about $1.3 million, as you alluded to. When you sort of extrapolate and do the math, because community obviously does quite a bit of claims through Medicare, that added up in their mind to $22 million, which is, of course, something that community is pretty hotly contesting. Their response to the audit said, obviously, that they're going to appeal this right away, and they disputed that $22 million figure, that they basically said it was excessive, and they didn't feel there was sufficient proof to add up to that amount.
I also know, too, that in your story, you mentioned, too, that the hospital was rather critical about the way that the auditors had come up with their methods that, in turn, find us in the report. Tell us what the hospital had to say about what the auditors may have or may not have done.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was obviously a lot of very technical things in the audit, but basically that the hospital is saying that they felt that the methods that these auditors used were, quote, flawed, inappropriate, premature. Luis Molina, who is the CEO of community, wrote as well that, you know, he thought that the amount was grossly excessive, and if they were forced to pay it, that it would have, quote, dire consequences for the hospital. So they basically obviously don't want to pay this. It's in appeals right now. When hospitals appeal these kind of audits through Medicare, apparently they go through five levels of appeal, and once you get past the second level, I guess, is when they would be liable to pay.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see how much, if anything, really, that community hospital may have to pay out of all this based on the audit and the findings, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and it's important to note as well is that this report is saying that community does up to, this is over 2 years, 2015 and 16, dated $275 million through Medicaid claims. So that's obviously a big, big amount of money.
We're talking with Meredith Colius-Pete, who at the Post Tribune, on the stories that she's covered recently here. And one of the other stories deals with education. It's about a school that most people know as the Frankie McCullough Academy for Girls, but That may be a change in that. Tell us about what they're planning as far as the emergency management team about the school.
Sure. Well, pretty recently, Gary Schools goes down to the Distressed Unit Appeals Board in Indianapolis. It's sort of a financial overseer, just because it's a school district or entity that's in a heavy amount of debt, so they sort of watch over them. Basically, the emergency manager over in Gary announced recently that they're looking to turn McCullough back into a boys and girls school.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the issues that they were looking at, which is that the school over there, it's about on 21st Street or so in Gary, that it has about 275 students right now, which are all girls, obviously, and that's about one-third of its capacity. When they've been talking to parents, the feedback that they've been getting is basically they don't want to split up their kids and send their sons to one school and their daughters to another school. So the implication has been that they're either going to private schools or charter schools. And, of course, Gary wants to get those kids back.
Oh, yeah. That's just, they'll be more than happy to change a girls' school into a co-ed school to be sure to keep everybody in the school, period.
Yeah, and another part of that plan that's been floated, there's nothing kind of solid on that yet, is that they could use part of the space at McCullough to turn it into a second pre-K center after Bethune. Bethune, of course, and, you know, Gary schools obviously have a reputation for, you know, being very distressed and having a lot of problems. But Bethune Pre-K Center is very beloved in Gary by a lot of parents. It's, you know, where they send preschoolers to sort of, you know, get their start in school. And it's, you know, very crucial years for them. And there had been some talk in Gary whether or not that they wanted to keep Bethune running. But I think that the feedback that they've been getting is very positive from parents. And so, in fact, it's so positive that they're saying that Gary is saying that they're actually turning away about 200 pre-K students from Bethune. And so if they do decide to have a second pre-K center in part of McCullough, the long-term goal for Gary is to sort of keep those kids in the school system.
That's good news. Good news to hear, too. Also, too, what's the latest that they've passed along to you about the state of the situation with Theodore Roosevelt College and Career Academy? They have some big repair bills, I'm sure, that they're going to have to deal with pretty soon.
Yeah, absolutely. A few weeks ago when we had that really, really cold weather, some water pipes burst over at Roosevelt. It's a 98-year-old school. My colleague Carol Carlson has reported pretty extensively on this, of course.
Yeah.
They don't know yet. They're still looking to see the extent of the damage and how long it's going to how much it's going to cost. Since Valentine's Day, the kids at Roosevelt have been transferred over to the Gary Career Center. That is temporary, but of course, really the big question for this is how much are those repairs going to cost at Roosevelt. It's my understanding that the former emergency manager, Peggy Hinckley, had told, because Roosevelt, the building, is owned by the Gary Community School Corporation, but since 2011, so it's been privately managed by Edison Learning, and there's a contract where Edison is handling, like, all the schools and academics there, that the Gary Community School Corporation told them, basically, that if there was an issue with heating again, which there has been, if you'll remember, in the past couple of years, I think at least three times that they've had no heat in the schools during the winter because of issues, that they would move them over to the Gary Career Center. Not to get, you know, too complicated here or whatever, but so basically that's the issue. We're sort of in a wait and see. The big question is how much is this going to cost, or if the final bill comes back, is it going to be too much for Gary to pay?
And they may have to decide whether they're going to be able to keep the school, the physical building, open, I suppose, yeah.
That's my guess, you know, that's my guess. And we don't know at this point. We're sort of waiting to see, you know, when they're able to do the final assessments, which they say they have to wait until the weather gets a little bit warmer. So we're kind of waiting to see what they find out.
Okay. One of the other stories you happen to put out there online as well as in print in the Post Tribune is a great story about an 18-year-old from a Lake Ridge School District. She's picked up an honor, a volunteerism honor, and she has a very, very special person in her life who has basically spurred her on to be able to do this. Tell us about Sylvia Williams.
Yeah, Sylvia Williams is a senior at Lake Ridge. She's a great kid. She recently is a sort of a state finalist for this Prudential Spirit of Community Awards. It's you know, a little honor that Prudential Financial gives to you know, teens for their volunteer work. And so, a few years ago or so, her really beloved uncle died in October 2017. You can imagine they're very close in age. You know, hung out, loved to listen to music, dance to Michael Jackson, all that good stuff. You know, it really hit her pretty hard. And her mom, her mom had already kind of been involved in various volunteer work, and she would kind of go to clothing drives with her moms and stuff like that. So the death of her uncle really kind of motivated her. She kind of, you know, needed a little bit of a distraction. And so, you know, put that grief to really good use, you know, began collecting, you know, clothes and food and school supplies and baby items and stuff like that for charity. So it's a really, really cool family.
Now, what is Sylvia's plan for her future once she finishes up at Lake Ridge Schools?
Well, she's pretty idealistic, and she's interested in the medical field. She is going to IU Bloomington. And her plan is eventually to go on to medical school to become an anesthesiologist. I guess she is one of 9 siblings, and a bunch of her older siblings are nurses, and so it's kind of, you know, following in their footsteps.
That's great. That's great news to hear, too. One of the other stories, too, that we occasionally hear about is about the Special Olympics, and they do have Special Olympics activities here in Lake County in particular. Tell us about the latest efforts to set up a regular basketball tournament here in Lake County for the Special Olympic participants.
Yeah, this past Sunday at Lake Central, Special Olympics in Lake County had their first basketball tournament for folks with special needs. It's not particularly unique. I've been kind of talking to the players. Apparently there's basketball tournaments and stuff like this going on pretty regularly. But, you know, it was pretty cool. It was a fun time. There were about 200 players there, about 400, you know, in total between, like, families and, you know, friends and stuff like that. You know, you just had a bunch of folks on the floor just having a good time and playing some basketball. You know, one player I got to speak with was Christian Huber. He's about 22 years old from Dyer. Apparently when he was born, he had one functioning lung, you know, had some learning disabilities, probably due to his adopted dad things, lack of oxygen when he was born, stuff like that. But, I mean, he just, you know, took to basketball at an early age and played at the Westlake Special Education Cooperative high school basketball team, which until recently was sort of a partnership between, I believe, Lake Central and Munster. Mm-hmm. You know, and has been, you know, just been playing basketball since he was a little kid and was kind of out there having a good time. You know, lucky for him, his team did advance to the sectionals, and that's going to be, if anybody's interested, Valpo University, I think, on March 16th.
That's right. That's right. How many teams are going to be over there in Valparaiso that are going to be participating in the sectional?
Well, in the sectional, I'm just going to refresh my memory here. I believe 25, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Sounds about right. Yeah. It's still a nice participation when you have that many teams participate from Northwest Indiana. And then, of course, they're going to funnel it into Indianapolis. I know the finals are always held down at Indianapolis at one of the high schools down there.
Yeah. It is a lot of fun. Those finals are going to be at Ben Davis High School on March 23rd and 24th. So, yeah, and I guess that there's about 50 teams from the state that are going to make it to that point. You know, Christian, of course, wants to go all the way. He's pretty competitive. But, you know, it was just fun. It was a fun time. There are lots of cool volunteers. And, you know, you'd imagine that the refs kind of just let people play. They weren't going to get, you know, too nitpicky about calling fouls or anything like that just to prevent people from, you know, getting hurt. But, you know, everybody just had a good time. It was a really fun community event.
Well, that's the important thing, is that the participants, as well as all the teams and all the parents and other family members that join in watching the events that take place, that they enjoy it as well, too. It's a competition that everybody's supposed to take away with something to be sure about. So we have Special Olympics activities that are continuing on very soon. And as always, we thank you, Meredith Kolias-Pete, for joining us to tell us about the stories that you've been working on here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your Meredith Kolias-Pete is a reporter for the Post-Tribune. Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Carol Carlson with the Post-Tribune. Carol, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a great stories that you've been able to put out there in print and online. And let's start out with the one that everybody, at least in the city of Gary, is very watching very closely. And for that matter, other people in Northwest Indiana that want to make sure that economic development projects continue on. We know at the State House that they've worked up a bill that affects the plans for the economic engine, or at least that's the way that the city puts it, there at Buffington Harbor, and the airport nearby, too. Tell us about Senate Bill 66.
Well, I can tell you that as of this morning, it did pass out of the Senate Appropriations Committee. So it, along with Senate Bill 552, which is a related bill in that it involves the movement of a casino inland, both of those measures are now headed to the full Senate floor, where they will face second reading. They can be amended at that time, and then they'll go on to a third reading and a full Senate vote. And presuming that they pass, they will move over to the House. So I guess you could say that this bill is moving along. It establishes transmodal network at Buffington Harbor that's dependent on the movement of the Majestic Star boats there.
I understand that this, of course, the bill has much more mentions and specifics, but the measure also talks about a special governing body of sorts that is going to be set up as a result of the bill that will, I guess, keep an eye or how actually run, maybe not to actually run this intermodal facility, but at least it will be in charge of it, won't it?
Yeah, the body doesn't have a specific name yet. They're calling it a compact. It would be made up of some Gary officials. I believe it's two Gary appointments from the mayor, and the rest of them, I believe it's a five-member, it might be seven.
Mm-hmm.
But the swing votes would go to the governor's office, so I believe it's four state appointments and three Gary mayoral appointments. I believe that's the way it's set up. And the Gary mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson, would prefer that perhaps that makeup was switched so Gary would have a larger say in the development.
I suppose that there's some reasoning behind it, but I'm sure that the mayor, Freeman Wilson, would rather have had, instead of only two appointments, to be able to make three or four or some other appointments, too. We know that the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority is going to be represented on the panel, too, as well as these other representatives from, no doubt, outside the region. What would this this board be allowed to do if the measure makes it through into law?
Well, it's a little complicated, but it would initially be funded from revenue from the, it's not no longer going to be called Majestic Star, but once that casino moves inland and is up and going, some of the initial revenue from that casino would be funneled to this compact to allow it to do a number of things,
mm-hmm.
Finance projects, issue bonds, and lease property. It could do a number of things with that money. So that's how they're going about the initial funding. The Gaming Commission, though, it should be mentioned, the sale of the casino has not been completed yet. Spectacle Entertainment has a purchase offer and an agreement with Majestic Star, and I believe it's March 8th, or it might be March 7th. It's March 8th. The Gaming Commission is set to consider that sale. Once they approve it, they could close on the sale by mid-March, and that would be in line with the legislation and keep everything moving.
I guess, yeah, because you have these different components that all have to fit in together, and as you mentioned here, one has to be officially passed and take effect. In this case, the ownership change of the casino has to happen before all this other can take place, too, I suppose.
There's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, it sounds sounds very confusing, so I suppose it's best that we just know that if everything continues on as the hopes in the General Assembly, that everything will end up passing eventually, at least when it gets to the... I'm sure there'll be questions that will probably come up before in the full Senate when it comes up before them for debate sometime soon, since it's gotten all out of committee now, to be sure.
If I had to hazard a guess, I would say that the prospects are looking good.
Mm-hmm.
The initial Senate bill, not the compact bill, but the bill that the Inland Casino in Gary is part of, is also part of the statewide sports betting legislation bill.
Yeah,
so they're all intertwined together.
I think that Ed Feigenbaum, who's one of our contacts and keeps an eye very closely on the state gaming industry, he's referred to it as a gaming omnibus bill, because that's pretty much
right.
What it is. It's dealing with not only the dealing with the casino licenses, the two in Gary and one that'll be shipped out to some other city, wherever it may happen to be. It doesn't look like, well, at least for now, it doesn't look like it's going to be Terre Haute. I know they had their hopes for that. But just the same, it's going to go someplace other than in Gary. And then we've got, of course, the wagering bill, the online wagering bill. That's very important, too, yeah.
Right. That will also create another revenue stream for cities and towns and municipalities.
From your impression and what you've done in covering the story and the research that you've gotten, we know that the city of Gary is very, very interested in making sure that this transmodal project continues on. It's, I guess, a pretty much a key economic development point for the city of Gary. They'd like to, be able to tie it with whatever they can manage to probably spirit away from Illinois and Chicago in particular.
Yeah, Mayor Freeman Wilson said... that when she takes a look at that area out there, she said it is really, really made for industry, more so than a casino boats, which are, you know, more on the entertainment side of things, just because of the location. It's next to Carmuse Lime and some other industries out there that in a rail yard and all the highways that it's so close to, and the Gary International Airport, which is also right in that footprint. So she felt for a number of years that it would be more conducive to move Majestic Star to another location and really open up this Buffington Harbor and establish this port to handle shipping.
One of the stories that you've had in paper as well as online is dealing with the Roosevelt College and Career Academy. They have, of course, been set up as a very innovative school in recent years, but there is also another move that's underway in the General Assembly that may change all this. Tell us what Representative Robert Benning in Indianapolis, being part of the education component of the lawmakers, has to say about that.
Yeah, the General Assembly passed legislation a few years ago that established they're called innovative school networks, and they were aimed at giving schools another tool to try reform moves away from sort of the bureaucratic rules that a lot of them have to follow. They could try a lot of, innovative methods in these schools. What this legislation also did, though, was it resets the academic clock on these schools, and it avails them of the option of just using a growth formula to ascertain what their grade would be. And what they found out after the grades came out was the raw data was showing that the schools were still basically earning poor grades or Fs. But because they were able to use the growth part of that formula only, they were getting A's or B's. And This happened with some schools in Indianapolis and at Roosevelt. Those are the only schools in the state right now who are part of this network.
Does this measure seem to be on track to be passed, from what you can tell?
I think it will. Yeah, I have a pretty good feeling that this will go to Benning in his committee hearing. He is chairman of the House Education Committee, so his bills seem to have more clout than others. Since he is the chairman and guides their direction. He said that the way it's set up now, it's not real transparent, and it's very confusing for parents who feel that their kids are at an A school, but when you look at the testing data, it's not much better than other schools that are, in the poorer category.
Finally, Carol, one of the stories that you have actually put out there online stays with the city of Gary in a way. It talks about goes to Washington, D.C. because of some action that the U.S. Department of Labor has handed down that has some impact on a very important housing project in Gary. Tell us where Village of Hope fits into all this and what the Labor Department's concerned about.
Yeah, the Labor Department announced last week that it was fining a number of contractors who worked on that project. The Village of Hope was started with the Sojourner Truth House, who received tax credits through the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So it is a federal project overseen in part by the Labor Department, and it opened last year, and it's a three-story building, a pretty large building, and they used a lot of different contractors, and the contractors relied on subcontractors, and the Department of Labor found that four or five of those contractors did not pay prevailing wage or the accompanying benefits that they were supposed to pay with that.
What kind of impact did the investigation from the Labor Department result in as far as these contractors and subcontractors are concerned?
Yeah, the total fines were they weren't fines. They had to pay the workers what they should have earned.
Yeah.
That came to about $256,000. That's a good chunk.
Well, Well, sounds like it's an interesting project. Certainly, that they probably now have to keep an extra close eye on all these people that are working on the project to make sure that they follow the law, so we don't have any more violations to note
in
the future.
On that particular one, there were 53 employees that were affected.
Wow, wow. Well, Carol, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the stories that you put out there in print and online, in particular the stories here involving the city of Gary, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Greg Tejeda, who covers the city of Gary for the Post Tribune. Greg, thanks for being with us. Bring us up to date on the latest, I guess, first involving the Gary EMS Fund controversy that has come up at Common Council here.
Well, the whole EMS controversy wound up getting intertwined with the plan that came up last year to sell the public safety building as an attempt to lease it back and raise several million dollars to help pay off a lot of the Gary City debts. Apparently, because of the EMS short fund and the confusion over where the money went, a lot of the would-be investors would have bought the bonds that would have given the city money from the sale and lease back got scared. They didn't want to buy. It would have taken a ridiculously large interest rate, much more than the 8% that they had been paying would be the limit, the amount of interest they would have to pay. Anyway, so that's why that deal never got its final approval back in November and why it's still pending. However, it also turns out that back in December of last year, the city's tax receipts, it turns out the city of Gary came up with an extra $5 million they weren't expecting from U.S. Steel's share, what they pay. They've got extra money, so now they don't need to borrow as much. So now they're trying to reconfigure the deal a little bit so that they're saying that by the end of April they should do this deal. And as it turns out, the council Wednesday night took a vote that actually approved them moving forward with this. And they say they'll be coming up with money to make police and fire pension payments and also some payroll and insurance for your municipal employees.
I guess that's been a problem, I know, is just trying to keep up with the everyday costs of running city government.
Yes. And they're saying now they're confident that it will come off in the next few years. They'll be selling these bonds, they'll be able to raise some money, pay bills, plus the fact they're also claiming that in the next couple of years that we're going to be seeing a lot of cost-cutting measures. We're going to see a lot of things meant to reduce the overall expenses combined with this effort. So they're claiming that they're going to get their finances under control. It'll be interesting to see just how successful they are, but
and this is the time of year to be thinking about that too, because we have this multi-candidate mayoral race that's going to get underway and for voters to decide on in early May. So there'll be a lot of controversy, a lot of rhetoric, not only from the mayor but from all the candidates, and including one that I know is going to be probably watched probably more closely than certainly most of the others, and that's Jerome Prince, who is certainly well studied in taxation issues. He probably knows as much as some of the professors on campus, you know, about these issues because he's a county assessor. So I'm sure he has some ideas what he would like to do to help kind of deal with things in the city of Gary, and I'm sure that'll be part of his campaign when he's out there talking with people.
Oh, you don't see this as a Karen Freeman Wilson, Levita Sparks Wade brawl?
It could be that too. You just never know. So I know it'll be interesting to see with that. And certainly we know Loretta Sparks Wade has her own definite ideas about this, and she's expressed many of them already in her usual clashes with Mayor Freeman Wilson. So she may bring it up here, I guess, on the campaign trail again too, I would imagine.
I'm pretty sure. And she claims that she's carrying on with the campaign despite her own personal problems of she's not letting that interfere.
Well, it certainly didn't hurt her as far as being a candidate for mayor is concerned. The extra publicity, although not good for her personally, it certainly has probably given her a bit more name recognition if she didn't have it already, so to be sure. So, what else managed to come out from Common Council on Wednesday night here that is of note that folks in Gary and around Gary should know about?
They passed a resolution by Councilwoman Rebecca Wyatt related to disabilities. The councilwoman wants to make sure that the that Gary municipal government is actually as accessible as possible to all people, mm-hmm. regardless of whether they have a disability or not. And we should not just think of disabilities as something physical, not just somebody confined to a wheelchair. Her measure calls for things such as printing all government notices and government documents in larger type so that people who might have problems reading them otherwise will be able to get the information. And this was a big issue. They actually brought some activists who came before the council to urge them to pass this measure, and it did get a unanimous vote of support.
Well, good. That's probably something that should have been done a long time ago, and just would make sense to be brought up this time around here as all this this.
Well, that actually was concern. A lot of council people initially thought that this had already been done.
Yeah. Well,
but Councilman Wyatt claimed that it was still a little vague and that it was more they could do, so they came forward with this. Yeah, this came up earlier in the month, and it got passed last night, so it advanced forward.
That's great. That's great. Anything else of note here that came out of Common Council?
Another measure actually got introduced related to, as we were talking about earlier, domestic violence.
Uh-huh.
It turns out that when the council earlier this month passed a measure prohibiting the former Lake County councilman from being able to come to council meetings because of the fear that he might pose a threat or an intimidation to Councilwoman Sparks Wade, two members of the council actually abstained from that, had their concerns about whether or not it was a legitimate measure to take. However, it turns out now they've been getting a lot of people criticizing them. Why didn't you support Lolita Sparks Wade?
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make sure that it was clear they do support her. So they introduced this thing and ran the whole thing through, a measure supporting domestic violence victims. And that actually had activists as well coming forward, you know, praising the council for taking some action. And there was also Councilwoman Sparks Wade, who also had her own update. You know, she's coping with the incident. And although I kind of got my chuckle when she said she admitted she has one advantage that a lot of other domestic abuse victims might not have.
Uh-huh.
She was able to go visit friends out in California. So a few weeks ago, while we were suffering from the polar vortex, she was off taking walks in the sunny 70-degree skies of sunny California.
Well,
and she said that was a very relaxing.
Well, it was probably therapeutic for her, really, in many, many different ways, I suppose. So I suppose she's excused from going out there while we were suffering in the sub-zero cold weather, I suppose.
Well, I do have to admit, she did come back at one point for a council meeting. She didn't miss any activity because of it.
Yeah.
She was here.
Well, that's good to know, too. And we appreciate that. Well, Greg, a great number of things have come up here. And certainly we should mention, too, that these stories that we've just talked about here will be up in more detail in the Post-Tribune in print and online very soon. So watch for them. They'll be out there. As always, Greg Tejeda, thanks for joining us today. And we're looking forward to seeing more stories from the City of Gary from you soon.
Thanks very much.
Greg Tejeda covers city news for the City of Gary for the Post-Tribune. The month of February is National Heart Health Month. It's an awareness campaign to encourage everybody to learn their blood pressure, cholesterol levels, and their overall risk of having a heart attack. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson talked to the one organization that is trying to help facilitate that awareness.
Heart disease is the number one killer of women, and nearly 80% of cardiac events, such as a heart attack and stroke, can be prevented. In recognition of Heart Health Month, Minute Clinic is offering free heart health screenings on Thursdays in February. Minute Clinic is located in CVS pharmacy stores nationwide. And in Northwest Indiana, they are in Munster, Crown Point, DeMont, Chesterton, and Valparaiso. Senior Practice Manager Patricia Chavez Colombo, who goes by Trish, came into the Lakeshore Public Radio studios to talk about the awareness campaign and to explain why it's important to know what your blood pressure and cholesterol is, among other important numbers regarding your personal health.
Why a Heart Health Month?
I think it's just to raise an awareness to the community about that there is a need to really focus on your health and the heart health, you know, making sure your cholesterol levels and everything are within range of where they should be. Just like we have Autism Month and we have those awarenesses, HIV. So Go Red for Women is something that was sponsored by the American Heart Association.
So as part of Heart Health Month, Minute Clinic is offering free screenings.
We want to raise an awareness for high blood pressure and cholesterol within our communities and really have our population know that we're here to help raise the awareness and to understand that this is an important piece, and patients can come to us every Thursday for the month of February to get these numbers so that they know where they're at so we can help lead them on a path to better health.
Chavez Colombo says there are several screenings that will be done for people who visit the clinic.
We'll check their total cholesterol, their HDL,
okay,
their triglycerides, LDL, and then their ratio to see where they're at for risk factors for any heart attacks and strokes. We can see where their numbers sit. And then we also will check their blood sugar, get their vital signs, blood pressure, pulse.
Before you go in for screenings, there is a little bit of prep work to do to ensure accurate results.
Fasting is the best. You can come and not fast. However, the numbers are not going to be accurate as they would be if you are fasting for 8 hours.
Once patients get their numbers, they will be counseled on any lifestyle improvements they may need to make in order to improve their numbers, if improvement is needed.
So when you get a blood pressure, just so you know, for an accurate reading, you should be sitting down for at least 5 minutes, have both feet on the ground. If you cross your legs, it can actually alter the actual reading.
Okay.
Yeah. This is thin enough, so I'll put it up. And skin contact is probably the best way to do it if you have, like, a bulky sweatshirt or anything like that.
So
you don't want to, like, you know, cut the circulation off your arm or anything. But. And then you definitely want to make sure you get the right size. So if this was like this, that's not the right size. You want to definitely be over the Velcro portion, because you have different sizes of blood pressure cuffs. If you have a blood pressure cuff on and it is too small, your blood pressure number is going to go up.
Okay, so
yep.
feet are flat.
Feet are down, flat, yep. All right, so your blood pressure is a little bit high. It's 152 over 92, which is elevated. Before, we used to say that between that 140 over 90 was high, and now we're looking at 120 to 129 over 80 is considered high blood pressure. But everything goes into play with your numbers. So if you're stressed out, if you're running around, if you eat a meal that's high in salt, big thing, you know, watch your salt intake. So I always tell people, like, fast foods, fatty foods, fried foods, all are gonna impact your blood pressure.
And now on to the cholesterol test.
You don't pass out or anything, do you?
No.
All right. Ready?
Yeah.
All right. One, two.
Well, that didn't hurt. You're good at this.
Yeah, I should be. I've been doing it for a little bit.
You got it.
So if you're hard to get blood,
yeah,
like especially like your finger, if you squeeze it and it's warm enough, it ends up working just fine.
So what are you doing there?
So this is the cartridge that goes into the machine. You put it in, and then it'll take about 15, it takes about 5 minutes to run. And it'll give you your total cholesterol, your triglycerides, your glucose, and then your good cholesterol. So bad cholesterol, good cholesterol, the cholesterol that is the three sugar molecules in one, the triglyceride. And then it also, I believe it gives a total cholesterol and the ratio on the risk factor for like a heart attack or stroke. It gives you a score on that.
Do I want to know that stuff?
You do want to know that stuff, because then you know what you need to do to
prevent it.
Correct.
Okay.
So now it's just running.
So how long does that thing take? 15 minutes?
No.
Five minutes?
Maximum of 5 minutes. It just depends on how complex, you know. And it's pretty specific. It's very close to getting a blood draw. Like, the sensitivity to it is very similar to getting a blood draw. We calibrate these machines. So you have to calibrate them to make sure that they are actually accurate.
You were saying that most of the heart attacks and heart problems and people can be prevented?
Yes, yeah, so nearly 80% of cardiac events can be prevented. And cardiovascular diseases continue to be women's greatest health threat. And women do present with atypical symptoms versus a what the standard is of what you think of with chest pain and if someone were to have a heart attack. So
women's symptoms are different than a guy's. Correct. And they're not as obvious.
I think sometimes it's overlooked. As a woman, you know, if you are more fatigued during a day, which this happens with men as well, but if you're more fatigued during a day, you might direct it at, well, I was busier today. I had more errands to run, or I was more stressed out with work, or, you know, it's just women need to be more aware of things that are out of the ordinary for them. So, and cholesterol, if you're not aware of your numbers, cholesterol plays a big part. One in three Americans have either high cholesterol or they have high blood pressure. And then you have about 40% of people in the U.S. that their total cholesterol is over the desired number of 200. Some people have both high cholesterol and high blood pressure, which is going to put you at a higher risk.
To mitigate the risk, what would you suggest that they do to mitigate their risk? Just eat right and go to the gym, exercise?
So if you eat right and go to the gym, some people can get their numbers within range by doing that, decreasing your salt intake, increasing like a vigorous exercise regimen, watching your diet, decreasing those processed foods and fast foods, and really focusing on a heart-healthy diet. You can get it down to where it needs to be. There are others where, unfortunately, they're predisposed because they might have genetic predisposition to having high cholesterol. And at that point, there's that chance that you would have to go on medication. That's why it's really important to know your numbers, look at what they are, and then have follow-up to see if doing the lifestyle changes helps decrease those numbers and going from there.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to reporters Meredith Colias-Pete, Carol Carlson and Greg Tejeda for the Post Tribune, and Sharon Jackson from Lakeshore Public Radio. And I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.